All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
May you be seated, please. Good morning. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court. I'm meeting for our second day in Coutin County here at the United States Courthouse. We again express our appreciation to those in charge here who have made our state so comfortable and making this beautiful courtroom available to us. We also thank our staff who traveled with us and assisted us in being here. We're grateful to be here. The case we're going to hear this morning is entitled Crawl v. Hagedorn Hospitality, case number 50064. The case is brought on appeal by Daryl and Tina Crawl, and they are represented by Patrick Fannin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
Along with Terry Gogol, who will be appearing only, as well as Caitlin Scott, who's appearing only.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, counsel. For Hagedorn Hospitality, Stacy Beaumont will be representing the respondents. Counsel, do either of you who will be arguing have any preliminary matters for us before arguing?
Nothing from the appellant, Your Honor.
Nothing from the appellant.
Very well. With that, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Good morning, Associate Justices, and may it please the Court again for the record. My name is Pat Cannon, and I represent the Crawls. And I will demonstrate two primary things for the Court today. Number one, there is at least a genuine issue of material fact that the respondents knew of dangerous conditions on its properties and breached the duty of care owed to the Crawls regarding that knowledge. And number two, Idaho's recreational use statute, Idaho Code 36-1604, provides no relief from the breach of that duty. Returning to, before I jump into my first issue, I want to briefly lay out what that area looked like at the time of the accident. As discussed in the briefing, there's a meandering driveway, and in the back is the Hagedorn Resort. And as that driveway meanders to the right, it's intersected by a pedestrian and bicycle path. That intersection is guarded by two raised concrete flower beds. And the record indicates that left-hand turn for bikers coming down that driveway and making a left onto that path, because the driveway is turning right, it's greater than a 90-degree turn, and the turning radius is somewhat compromised because of those two raised flower beds, meaning if the bicyclist turns too sharp, they would collide with the raised flower bed, and if they swing too wide, they would collide with the one in the back. Of course, adding to the difficulty that day was water that had overflowed from those planters onto the surface of the ground. So turning to my first issue, there's
just a question on that point, sir.
Sure.
Is the evidence that the water overflowed out of the planters, or the sprinklers were hitting the pavement at that location?
The record isn't clear whether they were overflowing or whether it was
overspraying.
Or overspraying. But either way, Your Honor, the resort here testified that it waters every day, that it was its sprinklers, that it sets the spray time. It makes the decision whether to use spray nozzles or soaking nozzles. It decides the time of day it's going to run those, and unfortunately this morning the record indicates it's from 7:45 to approximately 7:15.
But wouldn't the cause of the water make a difference? For example, if it was oversprayed, the wind could affect the direction that the water came from. Whereas if it was flooding, that would presumably do that no matter what the weather was like.
Respectfully, I don't think so, Your Honor, because ultimately the resort, this arises out of its business operations. And whether it's spraying the wind, if the court's asking could the wind somehow alleviate its knowledge of water soaking the ground, no, it's its business practices. The record indicates in various spots that it's seen water accumulate there in the past.
Well, to be clear, I'm not suggesting either. I just wanted to know if you were able to lock down how the water got onto the road.
No, there's an indication that the run time was long. There's a dispute as to whether it was long enough to flood the area or not. But that doesn't indicate to me whether the flooding is occurring from an overspray or from an oversaturation.
And as I understand it, Council, Hagedorn denies knowing there was water there that morning, correct?
It denies knowing that morning.
Right.
But it admits that it had seen it accumulate there in the past.
Well, and I didn't see it admit accumulation. I saw in your client's declaration that she said there was an accumulation that morning, but as I read Hagedorn's testimony, it was, I have seen overspray before.
Yeah, in the record at page 119, in the deposition at page 70, lines 23 to 71, line 6, I feel comfortable, this is the 30B6 opponent who's been designated to testify on this issue. I feel comfortable saying I've seen it in that area.
And it being overspray.
I don't remember without looking at the record and reading the deposition if it was saying overspray or, but it did indicate that my reading of it at 70, line 23 to 71, line 6, that it was aware that water accumulated in that area in the past. And in fact, in the record at 151, the photographs it provided as part of its report show accumulated water, just a random photo, aerial photo, presumably, I'm assuming it got it off of Google or something.
And I know you indicated that. I wasn't sure what part of that aerial photo, because I looked at it and I'm not sure where you were seeing the accumulated water.
Well, the photograph shows the accumulated water just outside of that actual path. It's on the other side. You can see tire prints draining the water out. It appears to me that that's water.
Okay.
And I would argue that to a jury that that's water, and the jury would have to weigh that evidence wrong. I think one of the critical things here is that identify what are the dangerous conditions. We touched on one, the presence of water that was there. We would argue that their admissions gave us an issue of fact that we have the constitutional right to present to a jury. The water was continuously accumulating there from their business operations.
And so, sorry, can you help me understand where the continuously accumulating in their knowledge comes from? Because when I look at the 30B6 deposition, the question was, you'll see overspray from the sprinklers. Yes, I've seen overspray. You've witnessed it from time to time. I've seen it here and there, yes. And so where is the testimony that establishes Hagedorn knew this was a continuous, regularly occurring condition?
That would summarize it, Your Honor. This is an employee who, from time to time, he's not testifying. Well, he's testifying. He sees it from time to time. They water every day. So I believe this isn't a one-off occurrence like some of the premises liability cases discussed. It's an ongoing or repeating. It's not like in the Johnson v. Walmart case where there's a spill of something and the plaintiff is arguing this is a business operation. It's like, well, somebody spilled an unidentified liquid one time. No. Now, if the evidence in that case was that, for instance, the slip and fall was on water from a sprinkler system outside a Walmart parking lot, and the Walmart designee testified that he'd seen water from time to time in that spot, I think the court would have shifted it from a one-time to a reoccurring analysis.
But as I read this witness's deposition testimony, He also talked about, I walk the grounds to see if there's overspray, if I need to redirect sprinklers or make an adjustment to the watering schedule. So I didn't see testimony that I know this condition exists from time to time and I just ignore it. I read his testimony as when I see it, I do something to correct it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in front of the jury, what I would have argued is that cannot be true because there was water that day. She passed by that spot 16 minutes after those sprinklers ended, and it was there. And so he could not have inspected that day. And if he did inspect that day, as he said, then that's an inference in our favor that he saw it and knew it. Both cannot be true, Your Honor.
What about he just didn't happen to get there that day between the time the water oversprayed and the time she biked through that area? Why isn't this an isolated incident?
Well, I guess ultimately that's a question of fact for the jury.
But as a licensee, doesn't your client have to show that Hagedorn had knowledge of a dangerous situation? And I don't see any evidence in the record of that.
Yes, we do have the burden to show it had knowledge. However, on a continuous or something arising out of their business operations, and Justice Sahn, even if you're correct, even if that was a one-time deal, it does arise out of its business operations.
But the business operations has to be something that replicates in the way that they do business. And so we attribute constructive knowledge to them because your operation is giving rise to the condition. That's why you're responsible for it. And what I'm saying in this instance is his deposition testimony indicates when I see a problem, I fix it. And so there's no business operation that is regularly allowing and ignoring water overspray on the sidewalk. So that's my struggle with why isn't this an isolated incident?
I understand, but certainly if as you question, he just didn't get to it in time that day, then the business operation is failing. It's not there while the sprinklers are running. It's not identifying if, as Justice Mueller asks, is this overspray from wind in a one-time thing, or is this oversaturating and dripping on? Its business operations failed the crawl that day, even if it was a one-time occurrence. We know it wasn't. We submitted the declaration of Jimmy Boulder, who fell under very similar circumstances that very same summer from water being accumulated. Now, we can't introduce that to show the resort's knowledge that the water was there, but we can produce it to show that water was accumulating at that spot. And we can show it, we can introduce it to show that it created a danger.
Articulate what the business practice or business operation is. Like, for example, in the Safeway case, I think of that as we provide samples to our patrons, and the samples necessarily generate waste as well as dropped food on the floor. So what's the operation here?
The operation here is to run a for-profit resort, which includes decorative planters, landscaping, and keeping those safe, keeping those maintained, those as part of their business operations. And so in the pursuit of that business operation, this for-profit resort, there's evidence that it's allowing water to accumulate in that area. Jimmy Boulder saw it a few months before and fell on it. They cannot be inspecting every day. That statement in the deposition cannot be true. Or it is true, and they ignored it. One of the two. And the jury should have gotten the chance to hear that argument. But I don't want to indicate that the water is the only problem. The testimony in the deposition, I was going to read it, but I can tell the court will probably scrutinize that testimony about how the left turn is not intended for bike use, and it requires some modified speed to safely make that turn. And I do want to point out one particular spot in there. The resort during the deposition was arguing that my clients had comparative fault for going too fast. And that's an important context. And so we began the questioning as I asked, I'm trying to understand the thought process of how using the vehicular driveway initially resulted in the accident. And the answer was at the speed they were coming down that and then making this left turn, this was not designed for that. This was designed for straight vehicular traffic, not a bike coming down here at a certain speed and then trying to veer left off the highway onto a path. Well, how fast were the crawls going down? The evidence in the record at 146 and 154, the crawls declarations, they both say I was traveling well within control of my bicycle and at appropriate speed for the roadway conditions. So what we have here, Justice Stegner, you asked, you're not seeing evidence of knowledge here. Well, the knowledge for a licensee is to disclose whatever superior knowledge you have to the licensee. The superior knowledge was that you can't come down here and take a left at certain speeds. The crawls obviously didn't know that. They took it at a speed that they thought was safe. They deserved a warning. There was a speed, and they testified in the declarations that they couldn't have anticipated it beforehand. That's unchallenged. And so...
And my struggle with that argument is that's true of every turn. And so if we adopt your argument, how does it not result in every time there's a turn on any private property, somebody has to put up a sign and say, this is the speed at which you can safely take this turn. I mean, I'm just struggling with the idea that somehow there was something about this turn that required them to put up a sign that said, slow down.
Yeah, sure. So the evidence, the testimony was that it wasn't designed for bikes to come and take a left turn. It required some modification in speed. And so, Your Honor, you're correct. Reasonable-minded jurors could hear that evidence and say what that 30B6 opponent was describing was any normal left-hand turn. There wasn't anything special about it. It didn't require any caution. Why he would talk about it requiring lower speed and it wasn't designed for bikes to turn left there, I had no idea. But it's also true that reasonable-minded jurors could hear that evidence and say this wasn't any normal left-hand turn. Normal left-hand turns on roadways are designed for safe bikes, for bikes to turn left safely.
Well, but counsel, I'm looking at, I can't remember the exhibit number, but it's the map location I'm sure everyone's seen before. My understanding is that if they had been on the Centennial Trail, which is marked 3 on that map, it wouldn't have been a turn at all. It would have been a complete straight shot through the resort, correct?
That's correct.
So they were riding on a road that was designed for cars of guests at the resort, and because they wanted to turn there onto the trail, they were making basically almost a hairpin turn.
That's correct, Your Honor.
On a road that wasn't designed for bikes to be making hairpin turns.
That's correct, but they didn't know that.
And who didn't know that?
The crawl didn't know that it wasn't designed for a left hairpin turn. That's my point. The resort did.
But the issue I have with that argument, if we approach it that way, is the deposition testimony is in the summer, which is when this accident occurred. The resort is aware bicyclists use that particular path weekly, and they had never had an accident reported from a bicyclist making that turn onto that path. And so I'm struggling with, this seems like an isolated incident.
Well, we know it wasn't because we produced evidence that somebody else has fallen there. So your question really goes...
Right, but we're talking about knowledge that the resort had, and the resort didn't have knowledge that that accident had happened.
Right, and that's absolutely not required under the law. We don't give one free bike wreck. For instance, we can all agree that a drunk driver leaving a bar is a danger, even if he makes it home safe. The fact that nobody had crashed there to their knowledge doesn't make it safe, and it doesn't, they did have superior knowledge. They knew it was an hairpin turn. They knew They should have known water was on there. They put it there. Their operations allowed it, even if we look at it on this day. And
Mr. Vannon, that sounds like an invitee argument, not a licensee argument.
Well, the difference, Your Honor, is that if in your business operations you put the water there, you allow the water, you are charged with some knowledge.
No, you're not. Not to a licensee. A licensee is entitled to the knowledge that the owner of the property has, not that
right.
They should have anticipated.
Right, and this court in Oswald said, if you can show
that... And that was an invitee, not a licensee.
Right, but how you show knowledge of the business owner doesn't change. The duty that's owed changes. To an invitee, you've got to go out and inspect. They would have to inspect. But if they didn't create it out of their business operations, but if they're creating the danger, the knowledge, the way you show that knowledge is out of that creation, and that's the same if you're an invitee or a licensee.
It just sounds like you're advocating for a strict liability standard, that if anything you did in the operation of your business resulted in water on the pathway, you're liable. That's it.
No, Your Honor. We're not advocating for strict liability. What we're advocating is if you know pipes are routinely going in this area, and Justice Mueller said, well, it wasn't designed for pipes, but it's a public road, and road pipes are allowed on the road.
Is it a public road, or is it a private road on private property that intersects with a public road?
I believe it's a public, it's open to the public. There's no...
Right, but that's different. That's the invitee. We're inviting you to come to our resort. We've created a road for you to approach our resort. Is there anything in the record that tells us whether this particular driveway is public or private?
No, I don't know that as a matter of law. What I do know is its entrance is guarded by a traffic light, allowing people to, when the light's green, go right down that driveway. It's a continuation on the left from a public road. There's no sign saying it's private. There's no warnings or trespassing signs.
It's a one-way road, correct?
It's two-way. They're divided by those planters, Your Honor.
Well, there's the second street road that leads to Sherman. I'm just wondering if there's any reason why anyone would be on that road unless they were visiting the hotel for some reason.
Approximately once a week, going back to the designee's employment start date of 2008, he's seen, during the summers, he's seen bikes doing exactly that, Your Honor. It's a very common occurrence. So we're not advocating for strict liability, but when you know bikers are using it for that purpose, you know it is a hairpin turn. We argue they knew water was there by virtue, or at least in the Johnson case, for instance, or excuse me, in the Jacobson case, it's a land recreational land use statute where the party was trying to get around it by arguing willful and wanton conduct. The court said the most critical element of wantonness is knowledge, and that element need not be shown by direct evidence. Rather, it may be made to appear by showing circumstances from which the fact of knowledge is a legitimate inference. But we have knowledge that they set the watering time. We were allowed the right to ask the jury to infer, therefore, that it knew that that was overdoing it. There's testimony that the runtime was long enough to flood the area. You know, that was later disputed. I don't want to get loose and fast with the record, but there is evidence that it was there long enough to flood the area.
Well, his answer was no, it couldn't have been that long because that would have created a flood. So you have the flood testimony, but he's also using it to argue that's not how long.
He recanted that testimony years later, but I deposed the investigator who wrote it in the investigation, and he affirmatively recalled the person, that same person, verifying that was the runtime. So yes, it was recanted years later after a lawsuit. But at the time the report was made, before the lawsuit, had independent verification, that was the runtime. And he said, when he recants, it couldn't have been because that would have flooded the area. Exactly. That's what we're arguing. It was flooded.
On the exhibit that I was referring to before, who authored the description in the left-hand corner?
That would have been the resort.
Okay. And is that a disputed version of what happened?
I don't recall what's written on
that. Read what it says. It says, female seems to skid as she turns into the circle. This is they split it to skid. The male following seems to apply brakes at seeing the female skid and falls at some point. Female then looks back at fallen male, seems to bobble, balance on bike, then falling at the star. It is unclear if they were turning up the resort's exit or onto the pedestrian path.
Yeah, some of that's disputed. But this was videotaped, Your Honor, and they come around it. It's a violent slide by her. She falls, she breaks her arm. That is disputed. I see I have about 4.5 minutes left. If there's no other questions, I'll briefly talk about the recreational land use statute and try to reserve a couple minutes for rebuttal if possible. We believe, first, that the recreational land use statute issue wasn't preserved on appeal because the respondent lost on that issue, and now it seeks a reversal of that order, and that requires a timely notice of appeal. But if without waiving that, if the court's going to get into the merits, our argument is that there is the statute is not, well, first of all, it has to be narrowly construed because it limits rights that were otherwise available to licensees under the common law. Second of all, the statute, which is it was intended to limit liability, not to provide immunity. And courts have universally held that it requires a recreational purpose. And that purpose, what isn't satisfied here, as a matter of law, that the undisputed testimony was they weren't there to recreate. They were there to get from one, to go down that road. They testified in their declarations, probably just this moment, that they thought that was a public road. And they didn't realize exactly where they were going, and that then they knew if they took a left on that path, it would get them to their breakfast location. So it wasn't intent to recreate. It wasn't recreate. The only thing that makes it recreating is that they were on a bike, and the statute says that bicycling is a form of recreation. Driving is modified with the word pleasure, and the statute doesn't define driving as limited to just motor vehicles, or it doesn't even mention motor vehicles. So our argument on that is that this was not a recreational activity. It falls outside the recreational use statute. Unless there's any other questions,
I know you're short, and this hopefully will require a short answer, but in briefing, you've argued there's an independent basis for just a negligence cause of action here. Are you standing by what's in the briefing on that?
I do, Your Honor. I understand that I've read it multiple times, and I think that this court's intent wasn't to open that up to every kind of case. But I think there's a couple unique issues here. One is that, as I indicated, they're arguing comparative fault. So if they're going to argue comparative fault, ought not we be able to argue their liability under a traditional negligence standard? Why would my client be judged by a broader standard than they? And second, I think because we allege this arises out of their business operations, it's different. Again, they set the run times. They set the sprinklers. They decided how long after the sprinklers ran they were going to inspect. Those tend to lend more to an activity that was negligent as opposed to a condition of the premises, or both. They can overlap according to this court in Oswald. Thank you, Your Honor.
Beaumont, when you're ready.
Summary judgment, the district court has to construe all facts in favor of the non-moving party.
That is true, Your Honor.
And that, as I understand it, that was their version of events.
That is correct.
Okay.
So Hagedorn was not aware of other complaints or instances across that aggregate path area of any bombing or cooling or any other accident, including the declaration put forward by Mr. Boland. They had no knowledge of that. I don't know why he wouldn't have reported it if that had happened. And so you can't have knowledge for the corporation if you're not the whole idea of the children. I can't fix a problem if you don't tell me about it. And so with them having their employees that continue to walk every day, which is what they're looking for certain issues,
If I don't have knowledge of somebody reporting it, there's no way for me to think there's an issue.
Sorry, was there testimony in the record that a Hagedorn employee walked that area before the accident, the day of the accident?
The testimony, the 36 testimony from the Hagedorn landscape manager, was that he was walking the area that day. He couldn't recall if he had walked past that prior to Ms. Crawl falling or not. But he was in the area when it occurred. He testified he was the second person to arrive, at least of the Hagedorn employees to arrive after the fall. So Hagedorn did not receive any complaints or indication of that particular aggregate stone pathway was slick or difficult to navigate under any kind of conditions, including when it was wet or dry. It's obvious, beautiful North Idaho has a lot of weather, including snow, a lot of rain, that makes it so beautiful green up here. If that was really an issue, then that would have arisen at some point in time. Even in my travels up here, I get a lot of rain coming up here. And so if that kind of an accumulation on that pathway would create a dangerous condition, Hagedorn would have had some sort of a notice. That's why they go out again and continually walk those premises to make sure there isn't one. It is also undisputed in the record in the 36 testimony that there is no low spot in that particular acre pathway in which to cause an accumulation of any kind of water to create ponding or cooling. And so that would be another issue that they would look for.
Is that an intentional feature of the road? Was it built with a crown, or is that just incidental? Was it deliberately designed in a way that it would shed water?
That I do not have knowledge of. Hagedorn testified that it was flat across that area, and if you've been up to that resort, there is a slight grade to that area, just because you're literally coming from an upper area down towards the beach and all that. That's just a natural process of that area, so that it wouldn't allow that ponding. But that would be one of the things that they would look for on a regular basis. They would want to fix that, for that to be an indication of something other than just the stone pathway that they would want to look at.
Does the record disclose whether the anti-slip substance that the resort applied was applied in this area?
Yes, it did. In the 36th deposition, the maintenance grounds manager, which was Don Ebo, his crew had applied that, it's called Diamonds Clear, and then the anti-slip agent was Sharp Grip that gets mixed into the actual product and then it gets laid onto that stone pathway. And they do that generally when the weather gets fairly clear. I believe that he testified it was either May, end of May, or beginning of June, just due to the weather of that year. So it would have been applied well in advance of this particular incident.
And how often is that substance applied?
Every year.
Once a year?
Once a year, yeah.
That's it. Not before winter or anything?
Yeah. They do it every spring. So as the record shows, it's undisputed that at best the appellants were licensees when they entered upon Hagedorn's property, again to use it free of charge for their own interests, and that is a very narrow duty to warn appellants as licensees, which was not triggered in this case. Because Hagedorn had no knowledge that there was any type of a dangerous condition in which he needed to have knowledge of. And one of the things that I did want and back up and address for the other portion, which is the left-hand turn. When you enter onto the property, it's a single lane. On the public roadside, it is a turn right only, single lane that is identified very specifically, CDA Resort only, turn right. As you enter onto the private property itself, there's two signs very low, approximately the size of my council table, that says the four-lane resort, one on each side of the road. Can't miss it. So there's no indication that this would ever be a public road, even though there's a light. That would be akin to saying that any of the roadway, coming into the hospital, that's still a public roadway. I'm just going to drive through the middle of QPD Medical in order to get to the other side of the center for a store on the other side or some other purpose. That's not what it's built for. While it's open to the public, it is still on private property. And it's very clearly indicated, regardless if there's light on the public road, as such as there is here on the resort.
So, Ms. Boma, it wasn't clear to me where the right turn only sign is.
It's in two places, actually. On the actual public roadway, the actual roadway itself. You know how you'll have a turn?
Sherman? On Sherman? Is that the public
roadway? Yes, on Sherman. So it's on the roadway and at the light. It's also at the top of the bar, just to the right of the actual cap light itself, where it says CDA Resort only. And it has the arrow pointing to the right, which is obviously the roadway. And if you're in that lane, there's literally nowhere else for you to go.
If you're in a car.
Even if you're on a bicycle, you either have to enter onto the sidewalk, or you have to take that turn, or you're going to be into the lane of the vehicle next to you. So it is a turn right only.
At the, I'm looking at the same photograph that Justice Mueller showed during the appellant's presentation. The entryway there at Sherman and private driveway, it explains to me how either a pedestrian or a cyclist would continue on to North Idaho Centennial Trail. I mean, is there any sort of impediment, or is it just a walkway? How do they, what I'm getting at is how do they get across the driveway? Is there anything in their way? Is there anything that would maybe siphon them off to the private driveway? Or is it just an open walkway that they could easily pass over the private drive?
It's an open walkway. So North Idaho Centennial Trail is the actual sidewalk that runs on the north side between Sherman and the start of the Coeur d'Alene Resort property. And so it's literally just an open sidewalk. And it comes down towards that first street, and then it takes a slight right, as you can see on the photo with the green arrow, and it kind of cuts through the middle of the resort property out towards Tubbs Hill. There is nothing that stops a cyclist from coming off of the actual Sherman roadway onto the sidewalk that is the trail and continuing to follow the trail through the resort property.
So on this map that we're referring to, in the very upper left corner, there's a little green trail that apparently gets cut off, but it appears to continue south and then proceed towards the east, assuming up the north on this map. Is that what you're referring to as this area right here?
So in the upper left corner, instead of coming south, you're going to go straight.
Right.
So it literally is going to parallel Sherman Avenue until you hit the first street light, and then it takes that right, and then you can see as it cuts down across through the middle of the
But at the property. Point of the private access to the resort, the Centennial Trail, it appears anyway, there may be actually two options for somebody traveling east. They could either go south or they could continue to go east. Is that correct?
That is true. For to be on the actual Idaho Centennial Trail, it would be the one on the north side, but there is a connector that you can connect going straight down from Sherman going south to connect into the sidewalk. And that sidewalk will actually lead you if you go back to the west, to the public beach area.
So to be on the resort road then, that is the path that the plaintiffs traveled, they would have to leave the Centennial Trail for a period of time to be there, correct?
That is correct.
And this photograph shows, I guess if I'm reading it correctly, it says green pathways used by non-vehicle traffic. So that southward path, that is not part of the Centennial Trail, correct?
That is correct.
And so is that just a walkway designated by the resort for non-vehicular traffic?
That is a, yes, that is a walkway that has been designated for access, so that, for the same reason of the Centennial Trail, is it so that folks can access the public beach. Because in order to get there, you do have to go across Hagan's property in order to do that. And so they have provided a walkway for folks to be able to access that public beach lake.
That's a public right-of-way.
In the technical sense, I believe it is, but I don't have that direct knowledge to know if there's an actual public easement for that.
In any event, it is open to the public.
That is correct. Yes. Free of charge, they don't, there's nothing that stops someone from walking and using either that south path or going out to the east on the Centennial Trail out towards Tubsta.
Is there any signage that tells either pedestrians or bicycle riders not to be on the private driveway?
I believe at the time of this fall, I don't believe there is. And even today, there isn't one that says you cannot use it. There's obviously a lot of vehicle traffic, like a bicycle or, for that matter, pedestrians can use a public roadway. They just have to obey those same laws. So, and they don't stop someone from, particularly from using that. One of the things that I did want to address was the angle of the turn. Particularly, Mia Helens has stated that in the 386 deposition of Taganama, there was knowledge that it was a dangerous left-hand turn. However, that's a mischaracterization of that testimony. The district court found that as well, that there was no such evidence or no such admission in that 386 deposition testimony that left-hand turn was in fact a dangerous turn. What the lower court also found was that there was no evidence, there was insufficient evidence to show that we knew of any kind of dangerous kind of condition and the failure to warn the appellants thereof. In particular, it is undisputed that Hagan did not have any notice of any type of a potential dangerous condition with respect specifically to the Egerton Stone Path. And it's also undisputed that out of an abundance of caution, Hagan took that step to apply that anti-slip agent to all areas of that Egerton Stone Pathway. And in this case, at most, is about licensee standards. So even if this court indulges the appellant's arguments related to foreseeability under the ordinary negligence standard, in that case, it just doesn't hold water. The ordinary negligence allowing an unsafe condition or activity on a property is insufficient by itself to impose liability on a licensee. Wilson v. Boger, 81 Idaho 535.
Could you address Mr. Fannin's argument that the combination of the security report statement that the sprinklers were timed to run for an hour and a half, combined with the testimony of in the 30B6 deposition that length of time would have created a flood, that's enough to make this an operating conditions case?
Sure. So in the following security report, it does not identify in particular for that zone area. So those, when they turn on those sprinklers, there's more than 50 zones on any given time. And so, like, one side of the resort will run from this time to this time, which happens to be in particular this area of the resort, and from, if I remember correctly, 5:30 in the morning to about 7:30 or so in the morning. But that's the entirety of that whole zone, not one specific spot, and that is what the landscape manager was identifying in his deposition testimony. Does that answer your question?
Kind of. So are you saying that entire zone was broken up into subzones. I'm not entirely following how saying it was this entire area doesn't encompass the planters.
Sure. So you are correct that one zone will run with subzones within it, and typically the subzones, depending on the time of year, obviously in August you're going to apply more water to the potter dryer than you would in, you know, May or June. And so those will, the landscape manager will adjust, and Jim's testimony that I will adjust those as necessary according to the weather, but typically they're going to run anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes.
We've used the word overspray earlier today. In the record, it suggests these are drip lines. You don't get overspray with drip lines. And so were both sets of planters drip lines, or were some sprinkler and some drip line?
So the flower bed, the dividers, which show up as pretty red, those are drip lines only. And those drip lines sit on top of the, well, there's soil, but there's also the, you know, the base optic underneath. It sits literally on top of it, and it is solely a drip line. So in order for a drip line to actually reach the approximately 6 inches or so for it to actually have a flood, you can be on overnight, and it's not going to do that. Because it's such a slow process. But the when you're looking at that photo, all of that green grass, all of that, that is all spray. So those are going to be different sweeper heads than the drip line. So all of the flower beds are solely drip line, and the rest of the other areas, those will be some sort of a sprinkler head. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
And so the district court correctly interpreted and applied Wilson specifically to this case in saying that we only owe a licensee a duty of reasonable and ordinary care. As the Wilson court had held, the ordinary negligence of allowing an unsafe condition or activity on a property is inefficient by itself to impose that liability on the property owner. There's just no evidence in the record that Hagedorn knew of an unreasonable hazard on the aggregate pathway. The appellants have also argued that Hagedorn knew that the left turn was a dangerous turn. However, in light of the record, the district court found their argument was unpersuasive. The appellants have mischaracterized the testimony, and the district court so called attention to that fact that there was no such admission. The appellant also offers a testimony about another bicycle crash in the same area. Again, there is no evidence in the record to know that it was ever reported that Hagedorn ever knew that this issue had occurred or why it occurred. Further, there is no evidence in the record to show that Hagedorn acted in a willful or wanton manner related to the aggregate stone path area. Willful and wanton misconduct is a high standard, even beyond that of gross negligence. Willful and wanton misconduct requires evidence that the property owner intentionally does or fails to do an act knowing or having reason to know facts which would lead to a reasonable person to realize that the conduct not only creates an unreasonable risk of harm, but also involves a high degree of probability that such harm would actually result. And that is from Jacobson v. City of Rathdrum, 115 Idaho 266. Not only is there not evidence in the record that there was any cooling or potting of water in that area of the aggregate stone path, the record shows that there were no low spots in that area in order for that water to pond or cool at that location. The district court pressed appellants on their contention, that there was flooding in the area of that stone pathway where the fall occurred, and they had to admit that it was simply their interpretation. And the record shows, again, that Hagedorn their landscape manager walked that area on a daily basis, walked the entire property on a daily basis, looking for those different issues with the sprinkling system. There's just simply no evidence in the record that gives rise to willful or wanton misconduct. Rather, the record actually shows that Hagedorn took the appropriate precautions for its property. Thus, the district court was rightfully unpersuaded by the arguments made by the appellants and made the right decision when it granted Hagedorn summary judgment. And as this court has already pointed out, the case law in which the appellants significantly rely upon is all invitee law. Invitee cases require a much higher standard than a licensee. And that's because those people are being coming onto that property for a pecuniary or specific business interest related to the property owner. And that is simply not the case here. And further, I wanted to address the preservation of the Recreational Use Act statute. This court can affirm the district court's summary judgment on additional or alternative grounds. And while the issue of the recreational use statute, which is Ed. Code 36-1604, was fully briefed and argued below, the district court did not grant Hagedorn summary judgment based on the Recreational Use Act. Therefore, we have no grounds in which to appeal a denial of a summary judgment based specifically on the RUA. Regardless if we had wanted to seek it through an interlocutory appeal or an appeal after a final judgment.
Well, why couldn't you cross appeal?
So, because it was a denial, and my client would not have been considered to be prejudiced because we received actually what we asked for, which was summary judgment. And so it would be considered a harmless error. Generally, this court has held that it will not review a district court's denial of summary judgment because an order denying that summary judgment, neither a final order can be directly appealed, nor an order that can be reviewed on appeal from a final judgment in the action. That's for Vicki v. City of Lewiston, 154 Idaho 686. So, we raised, we actually supported and argued the immunity that is set forth in Idaho Code 36-1604. However, the district court did grant us summary judgment, just not based on the statute. So thus, this court could find and affirm the summary judgment based on additional or alternative grounds.
Seems we addressed that in Herndon just a few months back where we found that the festival's argument below that the statute at issue there regarding firearm regulation by cities was unconstitutional, the judge didn't address it, then they tried to raise it on appeal as another ground to uphold the summary judgment decision in their favor, and we held, sorry, you didn't cross appeal, you don't get to raise the issue, even though it was not even addressed below by the judge. So is that distinguishable somehow?
I would say that it is because it was not raised and fully briefed below, where it has
no,
been.
No, I believe it was totally briefed and totally raised. It's simply the district judge, for whatever reason, ignored it. So.
I understand. Sorry about that. Yes, in this case, the district court did address it, but chose to offer, to grant summary judgment based on the alternative theory of the licensee theory. I think I'm going to say that's a difference, that's a distinction, so that's slightly different, where in this case you could still affirm on the summary judgment and just either as an additional reason to the recreational use statute or in the alternative.
And my struggle with the preservation is Idaho Appellate Rule 15A, which talks about the right to cross appeal. And the second sentence says, if no affirmative relief is sought by way of reversal, vacation, or modification of the judgment or order, an issue may be presented as an additional issue on appeal without filing a cross appeal. And so it seems, you know, you're affirming on alternative grounds necessarily seeks the reversal of the district court's decision denying your motion for summary judgment on the recreational use statute. And so how are you not seeking reversal, vacation, or modification of that order?
I think when we looked at the potential for a cross appeal on this particular case, the fact that we could not have brought the appeal in and of its own was the deciding factor and kind of the distinction, and this wasn't something I could have appealed anyway, because you cannot appeal that denial of the summary judgment, whether through interlocutory appeal or through a final judgment appeal. So therefore, that would be the distinction of why I think that there's an ability for this court to go ahead and affirm the summary judgment that was given to my client on alternative grounds. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did.
If there's no further questions, I move another time.
Very well, thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time is remaining for the appellant?
2 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Cranham.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, in the deposition, I believe it's up on the record at 126, page 97, beginning of line 7, I asked a question. I'm skipping the first part of the question, but I believe I say, okay, so let me explore both of these. The intended use. It sounds like what you are saying is driving a bike down the road and hanging a left is a dangerous maneuver. Answer, if, dash, dash, and a bike driving down the driveway, comma, yes, period. Now, the deponent goes on to retract that. But the statement was there's nothing in the record showing that Hagedon knew this was a dangerous condition. And the district court said that exact same thing at page 8 of the decision. There is. Now, he does go on to say, and then, you know, driving down the driveway at a high speed, then taking the left, that would potentially not be safe. So he backed it off. But the words he affirmatively approved, and I should get to show that to a jury, he made a concession that he knew taking a left-hand turn there was a dangerous maneuver. The court in Oswald said, a plaintiff may seek to prove the land possessor's knowledge of the dangerous condition by showing that the land possessor's, quote, operating methods. And Justice Brody asked, what does that mean? Except the court says in parentheses, i.e., how they run their business on a daily basis, so that would include sprinkling, were, quote, such that dangerous conditions are continuous or easily foreseeable. The court went on, under this method, knowledge is still needed, but plaintiffs are no longer required to prove it by actual or constructive notice of the specific condition. And that test applies to invitees or licensee. It must, and therefore we ask that the court overrule the district court and remand the trial on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both counsel and those involved. We appreciate it. The matter is now under advisement. We will render the decision. We're in recess now until tomorrow morning in Boise.
All rise, please.